Welcome to The Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Dateline, Chicago, Friday, March 4. Hello again, Orion Samuelson, joined by Max Armstrong and some other people for our weekly get-together and a quick look at the markets. If we were really to go into detail on all that happens in commodities and stocks, I think we'd probably need more than half an hour a week. But this turned out to be quite a week on Wall Street because the market ended higher today, and it's the first time since October that the S&P 500 has enjoyed a four-session winning streak. And for the first time since early January, the Dow ended the day and the week above the 17,000 mark. And you can call the S&P 500 right at 2,000 because the actual closing number was 1999.99, so I would call it 2,000. And those are levels that some traders see as psychologically important. Now, apparently, the catalyst for today's gains, the payroll report for the month of February. They were looking for a much lower number than what the Labor Department released today because non-farm payrolls increased by 242,000 jobs last month. Now, you remember the days when that kind of a bullish employment report would set the stock market on fire, it would move sharply higher? Doesn't do that anymore because now traders look at that positive news in the labor part of our economy, and they say, uh-oh, the Fed could raise interest rates more than we expect. Anyway, the Fed will hold its meeting on March 15th and 16th, and that's when it will decide if there will be another hike in the interest rate or if they will wait until June. In a minute or two, I'll give you results of a poll on what some of the investors think will happen on interest rates for the rest of the year. But for the week, the Dow up 2.2%, and the S&P added 2.7%. The NASDAQ up 2.8%. And today, 7 of the 10 S&P sectors rose, led by a 1.18% increase in the materials sector, and Apple went up 1.5%, the strongest positive influence on the S&P 500. A couple of stocks reacting today. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, they've been looking for some good news as personal computer sales continue to fall. Well, today they reported better than expected results. As a result, their stock went up 13.5%. On the other hand, H&R Block, right in the midst of income tax season, fell 15.5% after the tax preparer reported a bigger-than-expected quarterly loss. And then the theater industry, a big jump for Carmike Cinemas, up 16.5% after AMC Entertainment said it would buy the theater chain for $1.1 billion. AMC also saw its stock go up more than 5%. But let's look more closely at that employment report that probably set it all off today. Here are the numbers. Non-farm payrolls up 242,000 jobs last month, and 30,000 more jobs were added in December and January than previously reported. The unemployment rate held at an 8-year low of 4.9%, even as more people did come into the labor market. And the only blemish in the report was a 3-cent drop in average hourly earnings, which in part reflected maybe a quirk in the calendar and the proliferation of low-paying retail and restaurant jobs. The employment report added to data such as consumer and business spending in suggesting the economy had regained momentum after growth slowed to a 1% annual rate in the fourth quarter. But now growth estimates for the first quarter are around a 2.5% rate after the Commerce Department showed the trade deficit widened 2.2% to $45.7 billion in January. But average hourly earnings dipped 0.1%, and that's the first drop in earnings since December of 2014. And the average work week fell to a two-year low of 34.4 hours last month, and that's coming down slightly from 34.6. Now, job gains broad-based in February, although manufacturing and mining employment went down again, but the services sector created 245,000 jobs after adding 153,000 in January. But mining, and that includes oil, dropped another 18,000 jobs after losing 9,000 positions in January. And since September of 2014, mining payrolls have gone down by 171,000 jobs since peaking in September of 2014. Now, today, the oil market did get a little help because Baker Hughes, that weekly reports on the number of oil rigs in the country, reported that, yes, there was another drop in oil rigs in February or in this past week, and that was looked at as friendly. So oil rose, and it also moved higher because of the employment report. But Baker Hughes posted data showing the U.S. oil rig count down 8 more this week. That makes 11 straight weeks of declines in that category. But all in all, we have seen the market come back rather dramatically. And now there's a poll that says maybe we'll not see an interest rate hike in the next meeting of the Federal Reserve, and as we mentioned, that will be March 15 and 16. And a majority of Wall Street's top banks now expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates only 2 more times by the end of the year, a downgrade of earlier expectations that, some were thinking we'd see at least 3, but now a majority thinks it'll be 2 interest rate hikes this year. Well, we have some interesting people to visit with. Max Armstrong standing by to talk to Greg Groh about the commodity market and the impact of foreign markets on that. And then one of the areas that continues to bother farmers and ranchers, the inability to get consumers to understand what it takes to produce food. So we're going to talk to a lady who was in on the beginning of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance back in 2010-2011. She'll offer some ideas on maybe how we tell that story. All of that coming up when we continue on the market, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Greg Groh from Archer Financial Services joining us in the studio this weekend at the microphone to talk about markets. How would you characterize this period we're in here now? We got all this data behind us here a few days ago from USDA. There are some additional reports looming on the horizon here in the month of March. We're anticipating planting season. We're watching the demand to see what's out there in the face of this stronger dollar that affects our exports, for example. How do you assess the whole scene?
Well, it's, the context we're operating in, Max, is that of a bear market. We have generally large supplies of oil seeds and feed grains around the globe and demand that is slack, especially in comparison to the last few years. So it's kept the market in mostly a sideways trading range. There are times when the market needs to source grain and the market rallies a little bit to get the farmer to move some grain into the pipeline. And then once the pipeline gets the grain, the markets fall back, anticipating the supply coming from South America here in the next few months. South America has had another favorable growing season generally across most regions. Yields are strong, and we're going to be competing with them here in the months ahead.
It's going to be difficult, is it not, in the years ahead to see much of a shortfall in South America? I mean, what we see down there is they're getting their act together, it seems. I mean, with transportation improving in Brazil, the economic barriers coming off in Argentina, that monster is getting bigger.
Certainly, you've seen the continued expansion of acreage, most notably in Brazil, with the changes in government in Argentina. They're going to be a lot more of a competitive factor in the global market. So what you say is correct. It's hard to envision a situation where we're going to see some type of a tightness in supplies develop anytime soon, unless we see a weather event someplace, either there or here in North America or in Europe, that disturbs the global supply balance. But as you say, South America is coming on, continuing to come on strong, and will be a very formidable competitor.
What do you think the mindset of the trader will be in this upcoming growing season? You know, we've proven that we can throw a lot of adversity at crops and still get an amazing crop size in this country. Is the market coming around to the point where someday these weather events are going to mean less in terms of market movement, market volatility?
Well, you know, you can build a case along those lines due to technology and some of the things that we've employed in the last 15 years here to offset what Mother Nature throws at us to some degree. But from my perspective, Mother Nature is still the great arbiter. And, you know, I've seen situations that despite a good early planting season and all the best technology in the world, if we have hot temperatures at night during pollination season in corn or a lack of moisture in August during pod fill for beans, yields can suffer and create some urgency in the market, or at least a change in psychology. Right now, your users are going to remain on a hand-to-mouth basis, not wanting to own forward ahead because they see a lot of supply available to them. That can change, though, and we've seen what can happen. You go back to 2012 when we had a major drought across the growing regions. We had a very strong market reaction, and you go back and look at those situations. That came at a time when we also had very large global demand still in place, especially most notably from China. Some of these components have weakened, but it'll take Mother Nature to really change the nature of things, at least as we see it right now.
As you look at the planting season specifically, thinking back to the planting of 2015 and how challenging it was in the Eastern Corn Belt, all of the problems that Indiana farmers had, Ohio farmers had, many in Illinois, you know, I think of the mess they had around Kankakee, the inability to get crops planted, and then Missouri. Missouri's agriculture industry was so profoundly affected, too, with planting problems. Yet we seem to have plenty of crops at the end of the day.
Well, all of those issues you just mentioned were offset by almost perfect conditions in part of the Western Corn Belt, especially Minnesota, the Dakotas, Iowa, for the most part, Nebraska. So by and large, even with the difficulties you mentioned, we still came up with, I think, the largest bean crop in history, and I think the second largest corn crop we ever had. So it takes a bigger problem to affect the market psychology. If you had the kind of conditions we had in Indiana take place in Iowa, you would have a generally different view of things because of the nature and the size and scope of that crop, you know, and its importance. But when Indiana and Ohio get affected, it's just not, at least in the current environment, enough of an effect to move the market that dramatically.
How do you analyze what's going on with the exports of our corn products? And I think specifically, of course, of ethanol exports and the demand for ethanol around the world. Is that going to be one of those areas that will continue to expand? And while the ethanol demand domestically may be set and kind of on a level plane, over the next few years, what about that global demand for ethanol we might produce?
Well, I think the global demand for ethanol and the global demand for ethanol byproducts, primarily the DDGs, that has been a very strong part of the component to ethanol plant profitability the last few years. But we're noting a slowdown there with China trying to rid itself of large surpluses of corn there within the country, which is diminishing their appetite for DDGs right now. I think the ethanol industry is quite excited about the prospects of exports of ethanol in the years ahead. As you mentioned, with the kind of a stagnant overall fuel demand here in the U.S. the last few years, We're going to need those exports to continue to maintain strong production in the ethanol industry in the years ahead. And so it'll be interesting to watch, but I know that from what I can tell, the ethanol industry has high hopes right now for building and furthering their export markets.
While we're on the subject of energy, noting how low crude oil has been and the expectation that it isn't likely to recover too much in the near term here, how does that contribute to the overall bearishness? Is there some weight on the commodity market, the grain market, Greg, simply because of what we see in commodities in general?
I believe that's undoubtedly the case, Max. When you look at the history of at least my involvement in these markets, almost 35, 36 years, the crude oil market has had a very big effect on overall commodity cycles. And I'm thinking back to the run-up in crude oil in the late 70s, the drop in oil prices in the 1980s, the run-up that we had at the early part of this century. It's certainly a very big component in overall commodity price levels. And from my perspective, until we get the crude oil market stabilized and it stops this free fall that we're in, it's going to be hard to justify major rallies in most other commodity categories.
What are you hearing from producer customers? How are farmers approaching this era of profound bearishness in terms of the big global supply, the not-so-robust price? What are they doing? Are they placing more emphasis on marketing or even less, saying, hey, wait a minute, we just have to watch our cost of production and get back here?
I think producers are more attuned to marketing. Over the years, I've watched producers become much more involved in marketing and interested in marketing. Unfortunately, we're in a time right now where price levels are below the cost of production into our second year of that type of an environment right now. It's going to cause financial stress. Highly leveraged operators are feeling it now, and we're seeing the results of that this fall. There were a number of issues springing up across areas. It'll start to become more of a factor if prices stay below cost here another year. You'll start to see more cracks in the financials and in many situations. I think it's going to take a sharp pencil, and I hear a lot of producers talking about ways, how can we cut costs? How can we do things that keep our costs down in this environment? And I think that's going to be the primary focus.
Conversely, I have heard it said that there are growers who are doing exceedingly well right now. Surprisingly well, maybe, is the best term to use there. They were prudent in expansion. They've been watching what's going on around them. Many of them are seizing the opportunity when a piece of land comes on the market to go ahead and buy it. They may have restrained their equipment purchases a little bit, but they say, we are poised, as perhaps others fall out of the industry, to step forward and improve our lot in life here. Are you hearing some of that?
I think that's especially the case, Max, in the Western Corn Belt, where yields were again phenomenal last year. You had a lot of extra bushels to market. The price, while down, wasn't all that terrible at the time of harvest. And I think the revenue in those instances was strong enough to keep those players in the game. And like you say, when a farm comes up and there's some action around, I think the big difference between this and the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of growers don't have the land debt that they had in those years. The debt equity ratios are much better, although they have weakened in the last couple of years. Primarily, that debt is operating debt or short-term debt. It's not a lot of long-term debt. So, and it's interesting to watch the value of land, despite the low crop price and the low revenue. We've seen land values hold up reasonably well. There seems to be quite a bit of investor interest remaining in land. And so that, coupled with the farmer interest that you mentioned, we're not seeing the type of declines in farmland values that we saw during a similar episode of low prices, in the last cycles.
Nice to see you, Greg. Come back.
Nice to talk to you, Max.
Greg Groh, Archer Financial Services.
One of the speakers at the recent annual Outlook meeting of the Phoenix Ag Club was Melissa Kinch. Her official title is Partner Associate Director, Ketchum West. But before we talk about your focus on agriculture, what does Ketchum do?
Ketchum's a public relations and communications agency that helps companies and organizations communicate. And I'm here representing U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance today.
Now, you were involved with farmers and ranchers at almost the very beginning, weren't you?
We helped USFRA launch in 2011 and really begin their journey in terms of communicating and earning trust with consumers.
How would you describe their success so far?
I think it's been kind of amazing. First of all, to be able to create the sustained movement And a lot of it is really focused on getting more and more farmers to raise their voices. And we've seen so much success with that in terms of improving storytelling and seeing more and more consumers being interested in hearing from farmers and ranchers. But there's a lot more left to do.
What do you find is the biggest communications challenge that a farmer or a rancher has with a non-farm consumer today?
Well, there's two things. One thing we find a lot is just the divide between the rural and urban populations is pretty big. And people on the coast don't often understand or think about the people in the middle of the country and vice versa. But even more than that, I think when USFRA first started, getting in farmers and ranchers off the sidelines, be comfortable telling their stories. Because understandably, they might have felt attacked or that people wouldn't understand them. But the more they get out there and just talk about what goes on the farms, the more they realize they have a lot in common with consumers.
When farmers and ranchers are attacked emotionally, they want to respond emotionally, right. And sometimes that gets away from science and the facts. Do you have any suggestion on how they respond?
I think the first thing is to remember why consumers might be angry or upset in the first place. Everybody eats, so everybody thinks they're an expert in food. And eating is very emotional. People feed it to their children. It's what sustains them. So consumers have a lot of fear, and there's a lot of misinformation. And if you start by understanding that they're just fearful about what they're eating and they want to do the right thing for their family, that might break down some of that defensiveness. And maybe even acknowledging, I understand you have a lot of questions, or I understand you might have a lot of fears. Let's talk about it. And try and bring it down to the human level versus kind of the attack, counterattack. Is probably the best way to start and think about things.
And have you gone into big cities to hold gatherings and hear from big city consumers?
Absolutely. That's a lot of what U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance has done and does. It's very committed to getting farmer and ranchers' voices in conversations about food that otherwise they wouldn't be there. So USFRA does food dialogues. They do a lot of events. They attend a lot of events. They do a lot of media, particularly in the urban core, where people are very passionate about food, but maybe don't have access to a lot of our farmers.
And then there's the movie Farmland.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Farmland was a great film that USFRA helped produce with an independent documentarian named James Mole, who really set out to tell the story about the next generation of farmers. It's about five farmers in their late 20s, early 30s, and their hopes and their struggles and who they are, big and small, conventional and organic. And it's been really well received, and it continues to grow. So it's received great distribution after it was in theaters, online, and now it's going to be actually available for teachers and in the classroom through Discovery Education.
You're hoping it could be used as part of the agricultural courses?
Absolutely. We have the long feature film version and then a shorter version that's made just for the classroom. So it's really a great opportunity to help teachers bring the stories of farmers and ranchers into the classroom.
I know USFRA has the corporations and agribusiness, has the commodity groups, the farm organizations. Can individuals become supporters financially of it?
They can. USFRA has a foundation now that anyone can contribute to. And even more important than financial contributions is just raising your voice and being part of the movement. So there's a lot of opportunities to participate in social media, at events. USFRA also has a program called Faces of Farming and Ranching, where young farmers or farmers of any age really can apply to actually be a spokesperson for agriculture. So from individual donations with the foundation through raising your voice, there's a lot of ways for individual farmers to get involved.
She's Melissa Kinch with Ketchum West, the company that was in on the beginning of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. Stay with us. There's more to come when we continue on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
So where do the markets start on Monday when we open? Well, on Wall Street, the Dow will start the week at 17,006. The S&P 500, 1999.99. Let's call it 2000. The NASDAQ composite at 4717. and the volatility index at the CBOE, the worry factor, will start about a tenth of a point higher at 1686. Now, let's turn to the commodity world, because it was an interesting world in the grain market this week, as we again saw weather come into the marketplace, particularly affecting the wheat market. And soybeans came on very strong today. Chicago wheat just edging higher, registering a big weekly gain on concerns over dry weather in parts of the U.S. plains. And the most active May soybean contract touched its highest price since February 23rd, thanks to some strong demand from top importer China. And for the week, soybeans posted a 1.7% gain. China is expected to buy 83 million tons of soybeans this year, and that would be up from 78.3 million tons in the previous year. The recent weakness in the U.S. dollar, which again dropped today, has supported the exports of our U.S. crops. And getting to the weather picture, the weekly U.S. drought monitor released yesterday showed that 21% of Oklahoma, the number three winter wheat state last year, was, quote, abnormally dry. And that's up from 1% a week ago. Corn lost ground for a second straight week, down 0.3%, and again, supplies are the main reason we're seeing that sell-off in the corn market. So when we start trading Monday in the commodity trade, let's first of all go to the Mercantile Exchange. The April lean hog contract will start the week at $70.97 a hundredweight after gaining 62 cents today. The April live cattle contract will start the week at $136.42 after a gain of 97 cents today. Pretty good comeback in that cattle market. And the April feeder cattle contract will start the week at $158.07 after gaining $1.15 a hundredweight today. Well, the commodity classic is history for another year, so looking ahead, several events still on the calendar next week. We'll get the March report on supply-demand. That will be out early in the week. And then, of course, on March 15th, we will salute agriculture, farmers and ranchers and their families in Washington, D.C. National Ag Day will be held on Tuesday the 15th. Max Armstrong and I will be there to participate in that event. And you're invited. All you have to do is go to agday.org and you'll get all the information you need on making reservations. They do a beautiful banquet in the patio at the USDA headquarters, the Whitten building, and that's the night of the 15th. Well done. Beautiful salute to agriculture. And then in the Dirksen building at noon, they have what they call the Mix and Mingle Luncheon, where we gather in that historic room and hear from members of Congress. We'll also hear from members of the FFA, 4-H, the AFA, the Ag Future of America, and also the Outstanding Young Farmers. Every year when we select the nation's four Outstanding Young Farmers in February, the following year in March, they attend and participate in the Salute to Agriculture at National Ag Day. And then at the end of the month, of course, quarterly pig crop report. We have the quarterly stocks report and the planting intentions report. It indeed is a busy month because planting is already getting underway in South Texas. Thank you for joining us. That's The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.